Thank you.
Alexander Hunt for the state and the Williams County District Attorney's Office.
Thank you so much. And are each of you ready this morning?
Appellant is ready.
Thank you.
Appellee is ready.
Thank you so much. As each of you know how the timing works, I assume that Mr. Figueroa will be taking 15 minutes first. The green light means you've got that full 15 minutes. Yellow means you've got two to wrap up your thoughts. And then red means you need to really close down your thoughts. And then the state will have 20 minutes with the same kind of timing sequence. And then we'll have 5 more minutes for Mr. Figueroa in rebuttal. So with that, we'll start with Mr. Figueroa. You may take the podium. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Again, Jesse Freud for Mr. Figueroa. This is a jury charge error case. The jury charge here erroneously authorized the jury to convict Mr. Figueroa of murder based on a predicate felony offense of aggravated assault committed recklessly, which is prohibited under the merger doctrine. The court here has previously recognized the error present here in another case, in 2021, the Keene case. As we will discuss this morning, there is nothing materially different between the Keene charge and the charge in this case. The state's contention that there is incorrect. For these reasons, we'll be asking the court to instead follow Keene, find that there is error in the charge, and focus on the egregious harm analysis because there was no objection to the charge error here, and have a discussion about the appropriate remedy because the state has suggested an untraditional or maybe uncommon or lesser used remedy for the charge error here, and that's reformation rather than a new trial. So taking those matters in order, starting with error. It's my understanding from reading the state's brief that their position is the deadly weapon allegation in the application paragraph somehow means that we're not dealing with a lesser offense of manslaughter. And the analogy they draw is to Frazier and saying that the age element that we had in Frazier, which both of which had an age component, that we don't have that, that the deadly weapon allegation here is akin to that, and therefore the way it was charged in this case is not a prohibited lesser of manslaughter. And what I did was, because looking at the court's opinion on Keene, I wanted to make sure I wasn't missing anything, so I actually pulled the jury charge from Keene, from the Hays County District Clerk. I have filed an exhibit this morning that I hope you received, which is Appellant's Exhibit 1. And I think if we look at that together, putting them side by side, I actually think Keene was arguably more broad.
Counsel, the only additional thing you needed to do was to give us magnifying glasses. That was the only additional thing you needed to add for each of us. We're older, so just for future reference.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I wanted to put them side by side rather than two pages because I thought it would be better.
Of course.
But I apologize if it was difficult. And I can submit it differently. But looking at them, magnifying glass or not, I hope that we can see that the way the B3 paragraph in Keene just said aggravated assault. And again, if the court would charge, it does, in the abstract, give the 2202 A1 and A2 definitions of ag assault. And then in the application paragraph, arguably, in Keene, they could have said that they charged A1 and A2. Looking at ours, I think it's pretty clear that just SBI was charged, so that should be 2202 A2. And the way I look at that is that the deadly weapon language was probably to make sure there would be no issue with getting an affirmative finding in the judgment. And I think looking at the prosecutor's argument, I think that's one place the court can look for support for that. I think is one place where the prosecutor says you don't even have to get to any of the lessors. You can just stay up here. And there was another place that I'll probably direct you to in a moment. But I think that's one place we can look at to say this is not charged conjunctively, as the state said. This is SBI with just a deadly weapon allegation. The second place you can look at in the charge to further support that reading, I think, is the application paragraph for the requested lesser of aggravated assault. And in the application paragraph for their instance, we're looking at it when we're trying to figure out, how do we read this? Should you read it how I'm saying, which is just as a deadly weapon allegation, or whether both are pled? I think those are two places that would give you evidence it's just SBI with a deadly weapon allegation. And again, I think looking and comparing the side-by-side hopefully too addresses that there is no meaningful difference between Keene and this application paragraph. So, because reckless aggravated bodily injury is a lesser included offense for felony murder, murder's manslaughter exclusion, reckless ag assault may not serve as a predicate felony for felony murder. And Keene reckless BI, so I think we're covered there too. So for all those reasons, I think we've got the same mistake here that we had in Keene, and the court should find that there is error, and we should instead turn to the harm analysis.
Before you move to the harm analysis,
yes, ma'am.
I think I understand the comparison you're drawing with the Keene case and this case, but what about specifically the age element versus the deadly weapon finding? Can you analyze sort of how those two add up for us?
Yes, ma'am. I think when we're looking at ag assault, I think Frazier, Lawson, and Johnson say that where state is what matters. Even if you wanted to make the construction the state is saying, which is that they pled both, assault in the abstract was also defined recklessly. So I think, again, even if you don't agree with me and you agree that the deadly weapon also pled A1, the abstract did also plead ag assault committed recklessly. So I think we've got both. And so I don't think we need to make the comparison to the age element that was made in Frazier. So turning to harm, looking at the charge first, I had noted two considerations when looking at reasons the court said that was because otherwise, besides this mistake, the charge was otherwise accurate. And so in my brief, I had given you two different considerations that I think are distinguishable from Keene. One is the sequencing of the lessors. I think that manslaughter should have come after murder. But the significance of what I said about the transitional instruction is not necessarily that it's incorrect. I do agree with the state that Sandoval did not say that an acquittal first transitional instruction is error. I agree with that, but I think what also referred in Sandoval, it said we will assume without deciding that a modified acquittal instruction is what should be there. So I know I couldn't say that by itself was error, but I think the significance of the lack of a modified acquittal instruction here is that you're then just, if you're looking at reckless, if you had a modified acquittal first instruction, I think the jury could have sat there and said, hey, let's take all these together and let's talk about the difference between reckless in all of these three lessors that were given. And the charge said you can't do that. So I think that that is a consideration here that wasn't really raised in Keene that you can consider. So that we did not cite in our brief that I wanted to mention. It's Al-Khayali from May of 2025 from the CCA. And that had a really strong state of the evidence analysis where the CCA did find harm in a situation where it is not the same error that we've got here, but we've got a hotly contested element situation, which I think is analogous here. And in Al-Khayali, it's a murder case that was charged under B1 and B2, and the B2 paragraph omitted the causation element. And the whole case essentially in May 2025 from the CCA, and I will, when I sit down, I'll come back and give you
okay. The
Southwest Third, forgive me. So in Al-Khayali, the defense was essentially intent and causation. And the CCA gives a very elaborate review of the evidence on those two contested elements and ultimately says, even though B1 was charged correctly, it tracked the indictment accurately, it tracked the statute accurately, the B2 paragraph that left out causation, that mistake was made because the indictment, but said, yes, we know that B1 was available and properly charged, but B2 was really the heavily contested theory. And I think that's what we have here. I think we've got a situation where all three of the lessors provided invoked the intent consideration. And I think moving to factor three, the argument of the parties, I want to focus the court to 8RR71, where the prosecutor said, even in the best case scenario for my client, he's reckless and he's still guilty of murder. And I think that that really hits home the harm. The agreed closing was less heavy on B3, but I think the opening, which was of similar or comparable length, really focused on there's really no intent difference here. You can do everything under murder, so you don't need to look at any of the lesser. So I think the argument of the parties clearly reflects that intent was the central element, and the state said you can convict even if you believe Mr. Figueroa and his defense. And for those reasons, I think this factor clearly weighs in favor of harm. Moving to the state's catch-all. I didn't give a catch-all consideration for the court, but the state did, and that was so short. I would say that that's actually evidence of egregious harm, and for the reason I just emphasized in the prosecutor's closing argument. If you don't have a modified acquittal first instruction saying you can talk about all the lessors at one time and wrestle with reckless, and you have the prosecutor saying a murder conviction is correct under the defensive theory of reckless or a lesser mental state, I think the catch-all shows they probably followed what the state said, which is there's no real issue under consideration of any of the lessors of intent because B3 covers it. So, egregious harm analysis. And if there's no question on harm, I was going to start talking about remedy.
I have a question on harm. What's the best evidence from the trial of reckless conduct only and not intentional?
The evidence that my client and the deceased shared a similar identical gun and that he incorrectly picked up her gun, that she had the habit and routine of keeping around chambered and he did not. Even Stephen Gomez's testimony echoed that my client was pretty proactive in that way about making sure. So I think obviously picking up the gun, carrying a gun around the house, I appreciate that that could constitute reckless under the definition given. But I don't think that there was anything leading up to it, unlike in Keene, where we had an admission from him that he fired a warning shot over her and just happened to hit her. I don't think you have anything to show that he was anything other than reckless. There was no reason to hurt her. Their previous disputes, he had been the one to say, you can leave. I'm fine, you are gonna leave. I think the mom had testified about my client calling her between habit and routine of gun evidence, the deceased's habit of keeping around chambered where he had the opposite habit, and the overall circumstance of there's really nothing wrong in the relationship on this occasion. We've got the Ring camera footage.
Well, what about the fact that he refused to call the 911 and then fleed?
Yes, ma'am, that's a great question. I think what the testimony reflects is he tried to call 911 through their Alexa device and it was disconnected. And then when that didn't work, the next best person he could think of with a law enforcement background and hoped that he would help him resolve the circumstance. I think it was really clear that his fear and what motivated him after was a fear of not being believed, that it was an accident. And so I think his actions were consistent with a fear of being believed rather than I intentionally and knowingly discharged the weapon in her face.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come back to you in rebuttal. Thank you.
One call. I think it's pretty apparent that the defendant could have called 911 from the very same phone that he calls Stephen Gomez on. So I'd like to go kind of in the same order with regards to issue three, the jury charge issue, and start by talking about the merger doctrine was mentioned, and I made a note of that. I've cited to Johnson v. State. It's a criminal appeals case from 99, kind of the beginning of this line of cases talking about felony murder and what can be a predicate offense, not the way that our statute is framed, and began to lay out the framework that we look at whether something is an acceptable predicate for felony murder. And rather than having the merger doctrine, all we look at is it a lesser of manslaughter? So that was the Johnson decision. So that's all we're at. Mergers, something separate, not applicable. Now, with regards to Keene, certainly an application that has a lot in common, but there are several things that distinguish Keene from the situation that we have here in terms of just what's written in the jury charge. The jury charge in Keene, Tway, it simply defines aggravated assault and then says, right in the application paragraph, you're instructed aggravated assault is a lesser included offense of manslaughter. We know that's not correct under Lawson. It would also be incorrect to say that aggravated assault is never a lesser included offense of manslaughter. Now, in the jury charge in this case, there's that extra element conjunctively, and did user exhibit a deadly weapon? And Ms. Freud mentioned alt charged it the same way, but it did not. So in the application paragraph for felony murder in Figueroa, we have did cause serious bodily injury and did user exhibit a deadly weapon. Then you go down to the application paragraph for the lesser, and it says aggravated assault, and it said caused bodily injury and did user exhibit a deadly weapon or caused serious bodily injury. So it split with an or, and instead of combining the first and second statutory means of committing aggravated assault, it splits them with an or. I think that distinction is meaningful. I think that if the jury is looking at both language, the different way that language is structured.
May I ask a question about that? What is the state's position about why were both types of aggravated assault included in the charge?
So, Your Honor, I was not the one who drafted up the charge, but from the way the charge is drafted, it looks like it was intentional that there was at least some awareness, okay, we can't just charge serious bodily injury caused recklessly, because then we're in the manslaughter world. As I said, I wasn't in the room when they made this decision, but I think you can in that jury charge.
Does the state concede that absent the second inclusion that the aggravated assault would be a lesser included offense?
Yes. If we had just included did recklessly cause serious bodily injury as a predicate for felony murder, we can't do that under Lawson.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I ask another question on this topic? So the case that you're analogizing to and sort of saying that the ag assault finding saves from the prohibition on reckless assault, is there a difference between a special finding on use of a deadly weapon versus...
There could be, depending on how it's placed in the charge. So in Keene, there is that did use and exhibit a deadly weapon all the way at the end of the application paragraph with regards to murder. Whereas in the charge in this case, we've got and did user exhibit a deadly weapon in the predicate offense section of the application paragraph. So rather than what was done in Keene, which was just defining aggravated assault in the abstract, the application paragraph in Figueroa not only defined it in the abstract, there's a distinct, here's aggravated assault, serious bodily injury, recklessly, while using or exhibiting a deadly weapon. The deadly weapon doesn't appear somewhere else. It's not a separate finding. So I think that that is a meaningful difference in terms of whether that is an element of the offense or just a finding. So the next point that I'd like to move on to is with regard to Lawson v. State. And Fraser, there was a representation by Mr. Figueroa that basically citing for the holding that, look, aggravated assault is a lesser included of manslaughter unless it's you remove the reckless. But I don't believe that those cases stand for that proposition, and they actually explicitly allow for other ways of structuring a felony murder using aggravated assault. and I believe I quote in my brief, I think that it is Fraser, which recognizes that removing the reckless is one of the ways and envisions. Ultimately, there's a reason why they didn't just say, here's your exception, bright line rule. They said, no, you got to find the statutory elements of manslaughter and line it up to the offense that you actually charged as your predicate offense. And in doing so, you can make that comparison pretty easily. With regards to the elements of aggravated assault and distinguishing that from something like a deadly weapon finding or something that's purely hypothetical, we see this division in three different in this way, where they have, you can make this aggravated either by one, causing serious bodily injury, or by two, using or exhibiting a deadly weapon. Throughout the penal code, I think that there is a very strong support for the idea that the legislature meant for these to be two separate ways of proving the offense, meant for them to be two separate elements, and that by binding the state to have to prove both of these elements, you are raising the burden in exactly the same way as when you are removing one of your mens reas. It's not a meaningless distinction to say, okay, we've proven serious bodily injury, we've also proven deadly weapon, that's two separate elements. And I'd like to the jury charge and whether this aggravated assault is a lesser included. So with regards to harm, there is, I think, a very strong comparison with the Keene case. And actually, there's a citation in Keene that I found very helpful. And that's Sanchez v. State, 376 Southwest 3rd, 767. And that holding is that when a jury returns a general guilty verdict on an indictment charging alternate methods of committing the same offense, the verdict's. And so when this court was doing the harm analysis on Keene, the analysis that it did was it looked at, okay, we've got multiple different ways of committing this murder. And yes, we've decided that felony murder is off the table, but here are the circumstances that led us to believe that there was not egregious harm because of the overwhelming evidence in favor of intentional murder. And these situations are quite similar when you look at them. It's a domestic violence situation. You've got a defendant who is in the home, has a firearm, shoots the victim, and then afterwards claims, look, this is an accident. So in Figueroa, we have this same sort of proof. So if we look before the trigger was pulled, we have a family violence situation. There was evidence of bruising. Stephen Gomez testified to the victim, Catherine Gibson, having to cover up bruises with makeup. There was discussion of, should I leave this relationship? Should I go live with my mother up in Oklahoma? There were concrete plans being, and there were plans to not only move to Oklahoma, but take the two-year-old child that she shared with the defendant. So the motive is certainly there. And then when you look at after the event, we have, no, I'm not going to call 911. I'm going to call my friend Stephen Gomez. And I think it's pretty apparent from the testimony that he wasn't calling him to try and get in touch with law enforcement. He was calling him to try and figure out, how do I get out of this? There was testimony from Mr. Gomez that the defendant had actually tried placing the gun in the victim's hands to make it look like it was a suicide before thinking, oh, no, his friend can't help him cover up the case, and is very uncomfortably trying to extricate himself from the situation so that he can call 911. The defendant is then packing his bags, and you see on the Ring camera, he's rolling his suitcases out the door. There was testimony from law enforcement that there was a be on the lookout, they were trying to find him, and that he was avoiding law enforcement, that he was driving evasively. I believe there was some testimony that he wasn't running his lights on the car. These are all consciousness of guilt. And then when you talk stray bullet going through a limb and tragically ending up in death. We're talking about, and the autopsy is very clear, a shot that goes in straight through victim's nose, out straight through the back of her head, straight shot, eye level, kills her in a single shot. And that is extremely consistent with somebody who aimed, who is intentional about it. We're not talking about a shot going at an angle, nothing like that. So all of these factors in terms of the facts of the case strongly support that intentional killing. Sandoval, with regards to the lesser included instructions, it's a very complicated case that there's a whole lot said, but the holding is quite narrow in Sandoval. I don't believe that that's the Court of Criminal Appeals holding, that there is a better or worse way in general to write out these lesser includeds. There's certainly not a holding that says, yes, modified acquittal first is better, and that a strict acquittal first is just kind of okay. That's not the holding of that case. They're talking about specific facts. And when you talk about the language in Sandoval about doubt instruction would be correct, and so they're talking about both of those things in a very specific context. I don't believe that that is applicable in the sense that's being argued, that that in any way undermines the structure of the jury charge.
There were two other issues brief that we didn't hear about in the opening, but I wonder if we might hear about it in rebuttal, and that relates to the two-time felon comment as well as the extraneous evidence. Do you want to briefly
yes.
address those?
Yes, so analysis, but with regards to point two, and so point two is the 911 call where there was, and if you go listen to the exhibit, it's fast. It's a heartbeat of basically Stephen Gomez calling 911 saying, man, I'm afraid of this guy, he's a two-time felon. And that was mistakenly admitted, basically just a switching of an unredacted exhibit being put forward by accident. This didn't actually get noticed until after the witness testified. And ultimately, Mr. Figueroa asked for a remedy of a limiting instruction. He would have been entitled to a limiting instruction right then and there, and the court offered that. But he said, no, we will not be asking for that now. We don't want to draw attention to this. I think in light of how short it was, that any kind of limiting instruction is going to take longer for the court to explain than what actually went before the jury. So Mr. Figueroa asked instead, hey, let's put this limiting instruction in the jury charge so that, you know, the jury knows not to consider these prior bad acts, and the remedies available. Mistrial is the most extreme remedy by far. It's certainly a different standard of review, and the trial court would only have been required to grant that if it had undermined the ability of Mr. Figueroa to get a fair trial, and that the other remedies had been insufficient. There's no evidence to show that the jury did not follow the limiting instruction, sort of impact that would have on the trial. This has already come up a little bit in oral argument, but part of the argument from Mr. Figueroa is, look, man, I am a drug dealer. I don't trust the police. I don't think they'd believe me if I called them and said this was an accident. And also, look, I'm a scary guy and people are coming for me, and that's why I have to walk around my house with a gun, as part of the I was holding a gun in my hand just like every day that ends in a Y. So I don't think that the jury was ever being led on time. It was core to his defense, who he was and sort of what his background was. And with regards to the last one, the extraneous offense, testimony through Mr. Gomez, what we're talking about is just a notice requirement. It's not any kind of evidence that would have been inadmissible. In fact, it's very probative in this type of case as 38.371 evidence that goes to the nature of the relationship in a family violence case. The problem was that nobody knew about this evidence, including the state. You know, I had seen what looked like bruises covered up on Ms. Gibson, and I think that we did have a conversation about that. So the state did, I think, the best practice, which is they immediately gave notice, hey, look, we've got this extraneous information that we just got, and then said, look, we're not going to use it in our case in chief, but we may use it in rebuttal. There's not a requirement to give notice of everything that will come up in rebuttal. Of course, that's not practical, and it's just not what the law requires. And autopsy testimony by the analysts, there was evidence of these little bruises on victim's face that came up. They were admitted without objection, and ultimately, when defendant testified, he was asked about these bruises, and he says, oh, it was a sex thing related to giving her hickeys or something like that, so denying it. And so then in rebuttal, the door was then open for the state to go into, well, that's not what you told your friend Stephen. How it in, when it allowed it in rebuttal. And certainly there was no unfair prejudice. The only prejudice was of the type that the state is allowed to get into, which is 38371, evidence of family violence relationship.
And counsel, what is the relief the state is requesting as Mr. Figueroa mentioned in the way of reformation versus a new trial?
Your Honor, the state...
If there is charge error.
So if the court were to remedy by remedy, because in any of the three ways of making murder, even the felony murder, if that was not appropriate, the jury has found aggravated assault, certainly. They have found recklessly causes serious bodily injury. Aggravated assault is also the next lesser included offense. The state would ask for it for all of those reasons, as opposed to manslaughter. Because I believe that that's what the evidence supports and what the structure of the jury charge supports.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you.
Chief Justice, I have the Alka-Yali site for you.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Thank
you. And it's 713 Southwest 3D 780.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. And just to briefly kind of wrap up talking about error, I just went back and looked at Frazier real quick, and at page 570, to just kind of hunker down on my answer to Justice Theofanis, it says the culpable mental state matters when the predicate felony is aggravated assault, because the higher culpable mental, even if you want to agree with the state's construction that they have pled both 2202A1 and A2, we have assault recklessly then under both, and Frazier says that's what matters. So I, for those reasons, I still think I'm looking at Frazier right, telling you the right thing, that the deadly weapon is not what you, is not gonna throw us outside of being a prohibited lesser of manslaughter. So I just wanted to briefly revisit that. And just a couple things on the facts. Justice Crump, one thing pulled over. He did explain that his intention and the reason he gets the suitcases, I think there were some hats and some, but I think it was to take the THC cartridges out of the house. He said he was going to Avery Ranch, which is a community off of 183, which is where he was pulled over, and that's where his cousin had lived. And I think his intention was to go drop Brixton off along with all of the things he was worried about the police finding in his house. And then he said, I was going to go back home and face what I had to face. So I just wanted to add that to your question about the intent behind invading. I think it was to go to a family member's house, as he explained. From 2017, I went and I looked at how many other times this court or the CCA has reformed for jury charge error rather than done a traditional remand for a new trial. I didn't see anything else with the exception of Lennox that just came out from the CCA, I believe on January 29th of this year. That's the forgery ladder case that also had a sufficiency component. And so at least in terms of what our issues are, Artiga didn't raise raises both of the issues that we have here. And the Court of Appeals in Lenox did reform to what the CCA ultimately said was the appropriate lesser. So I do think we have a more recent situation where the CCA has signed off on that remedy. I think the hard part about that is, though, what is the proper lesser? Is it manslaughter or is it aggravated assault committed recklessly? And if they're kind of the same when we're looking at, what is not a predicate felony, I don't know which one you would reform to or which one you would say the jury must have found in order to convict him so that you can reform accordingly. I think that's a really hard question. I'm inclined to say manslaughter. But I think it's a really difficult question, and that's another reason why, while I appreciate the attractiveness of reformation as a remedy, because we just have really the issue of intent here, I think the safer thing to do is to remand for a new trial, because I do think the table, I can see why it's attractive, but I think that it's a really hard distinction or conclusion to draw which one the jury would have found to make reformation appropriate. If there are no further questions, I will just conclude with asking that the court follow Keene, find that there is jury charge error in this case, different from Keene, find that we do have egregious harm, and then we will accept the appropriate remedy that the court finds appropriate. If there's nothing further, thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate both of your arguments, and the case will be submitted, and the court stands in recess. Thank you both very much.